From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Brian Kaplan's new book, he says most college majors don't even try to teach useful job skills. It's one of those arguments that drives some of us nuts, the idea that it's only technical subjects that are really useful, that literature or philosophy or foreign languages don't make much of a practical difference for someone trying to make a living. In fact, Kaplan indicts the whole system, says education is wasteful, it values grades over actual knowledge. We first noticed his ideas in an essay in the Atlantic magazine, so we invited him to join us. Now, before you say anything, hear him out. He's not a dummy. He's a professor with a PhD at George Mason University, and you have an education, so let him try and make his case for why you wasted a whole lot of time and money. Join us after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out the Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. The economist Brian Kaplan knows what he's up against. Education is popular, and the idea that it's important and life-changing is pretty much self-evident, particularly to those of you listening to public radio right now. And Kaplan knows all of this, and yet, in a new book, he is making a case for how education is overrated and a waste of time and money. It's not that he thinks the system just needs to be fixed or that we're not spending money in the right way. Kaplan actually thinks there is way too much education. Too much. He says schools spend too much time on material he believes neither raises productivity for students nor enriches their lives. And the reason, he says, is signaling. It's a term that means whether or not a college degree is actually useful or helpful for an employer, signals something to them. Today in the program, Brian Kaplan is joining us to make his case. In fact, his book is called The Case Against Education. And we began the conversation with the fact that he has spent most of his life in school. Elementary school, high school, he has a bachelor's degree, a PhD. He now works for a university. He is a professor of economics at George Mason, which he calls his dream job, by the way. So why lash out at a system he freely admits has been very, very good to him?
Well, I see myself as a whistleblower. I mean, like in 40 years plus in the education system, I just think I've seen an enormous amount of waste of both resources, tax dollars, student time. And I feel like if I don't go and stick my neck out and point it out, who will? So, you know, I just see that, you know, students spend so much time learning material they're never going to use again. There's so much money that is poured into the system. And yet I say that the actual social benefits are much smaller than people think.
One thing that surprised me a little, looking at initially the Atlantic article that you wrote, I was struck at just how explicit and unequivocal you were in the way you talk about it. You don't really beat around the bush. Our education system is a big waste of time and money. And not only that, you say that you're cynical about people, cynical about students. Here's another quote. The vast majority of students are Philistines. You write, the vast majority of teachers are uninspiring. You don't really soft pedal any of this.
I mean, honestly, so if there were a subject that where I would arise inclined to soft pedal it, I would just let someone else write about it. I always pick the topics where I have something to say that people don't want to hear. What really inspires me is hearing people say things that just seem wrong to me for many years, and eventually it gets to the point where I say, all right, well, what you're saying seems wrong, and here's why. I know there's a lot of academics who just feel like, you know, everyone's so unfair to me, the media is so unfair to me, and like, I haven't encountered any of that. I think almost everyone has been very cool to me, and I just try to earn that by just being straight with people.
Where do you situate yourself ideologically? You strike me as a libertarian, I'm guessing.
So it is true. I've got strong libertarian bent, but I always write my books to appeal not primarily to people that already agree with me. You know, my approach is always, let's find some things that people that don't agree with me will still find plausible. You know, so otherwise you might as well just write a diary. So if you look at all my books, you know, each case, I don't start with like, here's what my philosophy says and here is why you all have to listen to me. I try to start with some facts and some observations that will make sense to people from a wide variety of views. And then, like in the process, I do try to be acknowledging and saying, well, look, you might say I only have these views on account of some libertarian philosophy. And I say, here is why I think that, regardless of what you think about the philosophy, you should agree with me. And again, let's just go to things that you've seen with your own eyes. So, I always say, just think about the classes you've taken. How many of these classes do you actually use in real life? Hmm. Right. And what was the point of it? And then, when I talk to teachers, we talk about going and improving their minds and inspiring them. But how often do you actually observe this occurring? Right. This is not a question of philosophy as to whether students are bored in class. It's a matter of look at their faces, see whether they're bothering to show up.
You say in the introduction that education is a strange industry. In what way?
It's strange because you spend a lot of time studying stuff that doesn't seem very practical. And yet, if you do poorly in this impractical work, it greatly reduces your career opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I'd say it would be kind of strange in general to say, wait, why are kids being made to learn this material? When are they going to use it? But then the added strange thing is that employers care. Employers care if you have failed Aristotle. Mm. Employers care whether if you don't have a foreign language. Again, not that they actually test whether you have the foreign language, but if you had simply failed the foreign language in high school, you probably couldn't go to college. And without college, you're not going to have your application considered. So in this little bit more distant sense, employers want you to have a foreign language that you're never going to use on the job. And again, this just seems so odd. Because you think of a business people as being very practical, being very hard-headed. It's like, I care about skills. Yeah. Show me the skills. What can you do, young man? And yet, more often when you're getting hired, they go and look at your transcript and see what a bunch of ivory tower professors think about you.
Why? Why is it that an employer who has to look at a bottom line, has to produce for shareholders and others, why would he care about whether or not a student has that degree, has some sense of, or took a class with Aristotle, as you mentioned?
Employers maybe get hundreds of applications for a given job, so they need to figure out a reason to say no quickly to most of the applicants.
Right.
And just throwing away people without the proper credentials makes great business sense. Even if the employer knows, so we're throwing away 300 applications. There were 5 good workers in that stack of 300 resumes that we just threw away. But which 5? Where were the 5? What would it have taken to have smelled out those exceptions? It's just, it would just take so much time. It makes sense for them to do it this way. Although, again, the heart of my story is that while it makes sense individually, given how much education everyone's getting, it means that from a social point of view, education's really overrated.
Yeah.
Because if we all had less, then then you would need a lot less in order to impress. Right? In the book, I talk quite a bit about credential inflation, just the way that over the last 70 years, the amount of education that you need to get any given job has grown up by a lot, even though the education that you really need to do the jobs generally hasn't changed very much. It's more of the more education people have, the more you need to be considered worthy.
Yeah, the jobs aren't really changing that much, you say, but the education level and the expectation of that is going up.
Yeah. Yes. And again, of course, the more education people have, the snobbier employers can afford to be. So, if you ran a fancy restaurant in 1950 and you said, we only hire waiters with college degrees, people said, good luck. Where are you going to find people like this? But today it's really easy. Right? You'll get a lot of applications from waiters with college degrees. So much easier to be snobby about it.
One of the things you say in the book is that we accept all of this because we're used to it.
Mm-hmm.
And on some level, we accept it because it's a game that we've all come to just accept. And in that sense, it seems like it works. Like it's a game we acknowledge. Whatever you think about it being good or bad, the fact is employers expect the degree. So it seems to me your sense of whether or not we're ever going to be able to get, extricate ourselves out of it is doubtful. So why bother, I guess?
Well, I mean, the easy answer is I am an ivory tower professor, and I just have great curiosity about the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of, you know, people read my books. Normally, I'm aiming at curious people, just people who look at the world and say, it's, when you really think about it, it's weird. I don't understand it. But more generally, I do say, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways that, that the system could be improved. It's just that people are so stubborn, they don't want to try them. But, you know, at least I want to go and put it out there. So, you know, like, you know, the big thing that I push is spending less on education.
Yeah.
Right. Which does horrify people because, the, you know, like people are thinking there's going to be one person there who doesn't get the education they need and it ruins their life and it will be all our fault. And I say, look, that's the wrong thought experiment to consider if we're talking about general cuts. Then you need to be thinking about how will this change the standards that employers have for who to hire and who to interview. Right. So, I mean, you really can go back decades and just see that you need a lot less education to get a job. There's been all this credential inflation. And I say that if education became less common, there would be credential deflation. We can go back to a world where you can get good jobs out of high school. But in order for that to happen, we need to cut the spending so much that there are a lot of good people who don't go to college again. And again, you know, like, so this is something where for the book, I went and read a lot of papers talking about how increasing government spending will increase access to education. Any of these papers seem very good for me, very good to me for what they do. But of course, the authors are primarily trying to push more spending on education. And I just say, look, we can just take the same results and just reverse the reasoning. If we think the problem is excessive education, if we were to go and cut spending, then we could go and get the credential inflation under control and go back to a world where you don't need college to be a secretary.
I guess one of the arguments is concerns that you hear from people is that when you cut, if you cut a public investment in education, it's going to disproportionately affect those of lower economic status, and the inequality is going to be really troubling. But it doesn't seem to be something that you're actually worried about. I think seems to be what you're saying is that if you in fact do trim the public investment in education, that it wouldn't have that effect. So work me through that.
So, I mean, here's the thought experiment. Would you rather be a high school dropout today or in 1950?
Yeah.
Right? And I say, look, in 1950, it was okay to be a high school dropout. There just wasn't that much stigma against it because there were tons of good people who hadn't finished high school.
Yeah.
Today, on the other hand, there's so few people that are in that boat that there's a very big stigma against it. Of course, the people that drop out of high school are very likely to come from families with low socioeconomic status. And I say is we should think about this when we are before we go and say, look, you know, Brian's proposal is going to be terrible for them. Say, look, it's just, like it's not clear at all that this is so. And, you know, when you consider the overall effects, I think people get very hung up on like the one super talented kid from a poor family rather than thinking about what it's like to come from a poor family in general. So, again, I can see a system where you've got lots of generous funding might very well be good for one poor kid out of 100. But what about all of the other ones that still don't go to college, where the fact that so many people go makes their lives harder? So I say, like, if you are concerned about social mobility, you should think about everyone. You shouldn't just think about the exceptions. You should think about the rule.
What is your standard for success? What's the measuring tool you use? Because it seems like you write about useful skills. So it seems like you're cool with the vocational classes, shop and computers and degrees that are directly career oriented. You write about like engineering and pre-med, but it seems like you really have a beef with the liberal arts part. That's the thing that you see as not entirely measurably useful.
Well, I mean, so, you know, here's specifically what I say. I say, look, you know, your education should either be useful or enjoyable. One out of two. If it's neither, then we've got a problem. So, you know, if you were to say, sure, liberal arts don't prepare you for your jobs, but students love them, like 4 years of liberal arts and you're a happy person for the rest of your life, then I would say, all right, show me the numbers. Let's see how happy these liberal arts majors really are. And that's where I'll just say, like, you got nothing. It's just not true that people who go and study liberal arts are going to be noticeably happier for the rest of their lives. And in fact, there's not much evidence that they're even going to be consuming much in the way of art or culture after graduation. Most people that even major in these subjects don't really enjoy them enough to voluntarily spend much leisure time on them. It's nothing specifically against liberal arts. I'm being completely honest when I say, ideas and culture are my life. I love this stuff. Yeah. I watch Shakespeare movies with my kids. I go and listen, and I love German opera. I love like this impractical stuff. But I can't help but notice that I'm really weird. and that most people, you would have to pay them a lot of money to get them to sit through 4 hours of Faulkner. Like, they just don't like it. And it's not just people that weren't exposed. People who are exposed are like, yeah, that sounds really great, but no thanks. You've got a huge group of people who just cannot stand this stuff. You know, they don't want to say it because it sounds really bad, but you could just look at their behavior by, you know, actions speak louder than words. In the book, I quote this passage from Steve Pinker, you know, who is famous professor at Harvard, mm-hmm. routinely voted one of the best professors on campus. He's supposedly teaching the best students in the world, one of the best universities in the world, one of the best professors there. And he says, look, I look in the middle of semester, I look at my class and half the students aren't there. So when he says, what can you conclude from this? It's like the students are not interested. Like under ideal conditions, half of them don't even feel like being there when they get a grade. Imagine how few would be there if there were no credit at all being offered.
But can't, I know you've heard this argument, I want to give you a chance to respond back, but can it be said that understanding history, knowing the mistakes that cultures made in the past, for example, or understanding how certain philosophies, like those from, you know, John Locke that helped mm-hmm. the founding fathers create a system of government, isn't that helpful in putting our day-to-day existence in perspective, making us better citizens, motivating us to aspire to have a better civic life? And in that sense, that in terms of a social good, we're less likely to be violent. We're more inclined to be empathetic and kind. And isn't that a measurable social good and a value that you get from a liberal arts education?
Right. So is it measurable? Yes. How big does it turn out to be?
Yeah.
And that's right to say that it's small.
Right.
The first thing to realize is that there is a whole field where they go and try to measure these effects. It's called educational psychology. Mm-hmm. I mean, most economists laugh at psychology. I mean, I know a lot of economists who can't even pronounce the word without sarcasm. It's psychology. And I say, look, what is wrong with a field where they try to go and study what actual human beings think and feel? Like, how can you dismiss that? So anyway, so there's this field of educational psychology where they spend a lot of time trying to measure things like, if you teach people one topic, which is logically related to another one, do they actually apply what they've learned without being told to do so? Right. So like if you teach someone the math of arithmetic progression, do they then go and apply it to the physics of constant acceleration? Things like this. Mm-hmm. Right. And again, the people in this area, they really want to find these indirect and subtle effects of learning. But normally after 20 or 30 years as researchers, they're shell-shocked. And they said, it just doesn't seem like this is the way that learning normally works. It's very rare. So yeah, in theory, it's possible that someone will read John Locke and they'll become a better voter. But it's astronomically unlikely. You know, most people, at best, they go and they answer the questions about John Locke on the final exam and then forget about it. You know, like even if they remember, the odds that when they're voting, like, oh, well, what would Locke have said about this? What would Locke think about Trump versus Clinton? Interesting question. Let's go back to the book. This is not the way that normal human beings think. I'd say that educational psychologists would tell us about making people better voters is you got to be much more direct and specific. You know, you would have to give them lessons like, you know, deficit spending past this amount as a share of GDP is dangerous. That might work. Although even there, the odds that they would remember what they were taught in the classroom and then use it as the basis of their voting is pretty optimistic. But again, you know, essentially any time that you stretch out the gap between how many levels of inference you need for someone to actually usefully apply the information, like every time you're basically, you know, you're like dividing by like 10 in terms of the odds that they really actually apply what they've learned.
What about the argument that education may not teach you what to think, but teach you how to think? You know, history gives mm-hmm. you critical thinking skills. Science teaches logic. And so it may not be entirely practical in that sense, but it gives you a structure for how to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's how it would work if it worked ideally. It hardly ever does. And again, this is where you have to go and look at the numbers. Again, yeah, like I completely agree that if you totally understood science, you would be a great thinker. Yeah. But how many people totally understand science? So the answer is, even most scientists don't understand it at the level of depth where they apply it to questions that they encounter in real life. So, you know, I've talked to scientists and just said, all right, so what do you think about research on nutrition? And they just give you a lot of nonsense that they would never accept in their own field. Again, the main thing to know scientifically about nutrition is we almost never have a real controlled experiment for nutrition because human beings can't be kept in labs. So you realize then that any result that you have about nutrition, you've really got to wonder, well, how do you know that this isn't actually caused by some other difference in the person's lifestyle? So scientists will often give you the very same kinds of half-baked answers that a normal person would, and it's really only within the very narrow range of their specific research that they actually think like scientists. And again, in the book, I cover a lot of evidence along these lines where, like, you'll go and give, you know, like advanced science students who have had many years of science, problems where if they would just apply what they had learned in class to the problem, they would get it right. But instead, they don't. So, you know, like, I think there was a study at MIT where they gave them a video game that worked exactly on the principles of Newtonian physics. And the students are just screw it up, and they just keep using their intuitive physics, which is wrong, but... You know, that's classroom physics. This is a video game. Two totally different things. It's like, no, they're actually the same thing. But again, if you went and told them, use your knowledge of Newtonian physics to excel in this game, then they could probably do it. But in real life, you don't have that narrator hanging around telling you which class and how to use and remind you. And this is why it just does so poorly. And again, there's a lot of other interesting research in the book that I talk about where it's true that people with more education are better at different reasoning tasks, but if you go and look at them at the beginning versus the end of any given educational program, there's very little gain. So again, it looks more like people that are good at reasoning stay in school longer and go into more and more programs, but they're not being improved during the program itself, at least not very much.
And you don't think part of the problem is that the reason they're not learning to think better is that they just have a crappy teacher? That's not one of the problems?
Well, that's totally possible. But again, in order to believe this, you'd have to think that crappy teachers are almost everywhere. Yeah. Right? Because, you think about this. So suppose that crappy teachers accomplish zero and good teachers accomplish something and one teacher out of three is good. Then on average, there should be a gain. It's basically two thirds should stay the same, one third should gain, and then the average should gain.
Yeah.
But that's really, really not what we see. It's I'd say it's totally consistent with most of the data that one teacher out of 10 or 20 is really good. Then you're realizing, wow, so in order to really get what we think should be happening, we'd have to fire 90 or 95% of teachers and fill their slots with people as good as the people in the top 5 or 10% right now. Where are we going to find these people?
So it seems like what you're saying is that if it's not just a flaw in teaching— Mm-hmm. It seems like that what you're up against is basic human nature. This is mm-hmm. stuff that we're not inclined to learn, mm-hmm. no matter how great the teaching might be. We haven't created a system that really understands human mm-hmm. nature, human yeah. indolence, human goodness. Do you know what I mean? Is that right?
Yeah, and human philistinism.
Right.
Of course, I think the people listening to this show are probably outliers. I bet they're very curious people listening in. But what I would say
there is no doubt that the public radio yes. audience listening right now yeah. is hating pretty much most of everything that you're saying, at least in theory.
Forget the theory and if you're listening to this right now, think about the people in your family that don't listen to NPR and how hard it is for you to have a conversation with them about this stuff. I'm not, this is not some ideological thing that I'm cooking up in my office. This is just from looking around and seeing what human beings are like. And again, if you say, well, that could change. Could you change your dad? Can you change your mom or your brother or your sister? Can you change your own kids? So if you can't change these people that are so close to you, why do you think that we can go and change and just have some fundamental change in what students in general are like? Again, I'll say this is one of the thoughts that really saddened me growing up, and just realizing stuff that was fascinating to me was boring to almost everybody else, no matter how hard I tried and how much enthusiasm I mustered. But there is a point where you have to say, look, most people just aren't going to change their minds. And this is where in the book, when do I get optimistic? I get optimistic when I say, look, some people are different, not many, but some. And for us, the modern world's fantastic. We have endless free intellectual cornucopia on the internet. And it's not just one-way consumption. You can interact with all the intellectually alive people that you could ever want.
That's Brian Kaplan. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University and a blogger at the economics blog EconLog. His book is called The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking, is the country's higher education system a waste of time and money? Brian Kaplan says it is. Kaplan is a professor of economics at George Mason University, and he has a new book called The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. I wanted to ask you about one of the arguments that you hear is that school, one of the things that is good about the education system is it teaches socialization, it teaches discipline. Mm-hmm. But I guess the question is that true? Is there a link between a work ethic and a school ethic? And this was a really interesting part of the book where you write about how the typical student used to spend something like 40 hours a week in class.
Oh, yeah. College students specifically.
College students, yeah, of course. And compare that to today. Yeah. We'll talk about this.
Studying as well as class, but like on academic pursuits. Sociologists have been keeping track of how people spend their time for over 50 years now. And this means that they can go and compare how college students use their time back in the 60s to how they use it today. And the big change they find is that college has gotten super easy in terms of how much time is required. So basically, back in the 60s, college was a full-time job. So again, like you said, something like 40 hours spent on all kinds of academics. So attending class and doing homework and projects and everything else. But now it's down to something like 27 hours a week, right? So, there's been, roughly like a one-third fall in the amount of time that students put in. And then the people researching this say, well, then what do the students spend their time in? It's basically just on having fun, right? So that, assuming like college is now a really big party. Of course, it varies by major, as you might guess. With the CS people are not having so much fun. They're still getting vitamin D deficiency while doing all the programming. But the typical student is having a fine time. I do say that I think it's extremely likely that school goes and builds socialization and discipline compared to staying home alone playing video games in your basement. But that's kind of damning with faint praise. Because, historically, the alternative to school is work. And, of course, work also provides socialization and discipline, and I say probably better socialization and discipline for the adult world than school, because, there's some similarities between work and school, like you have to show up on time either way, but there's also some important differences, like school is very much based upon fairness and work much more on efficiency. Schools teach much more of rewarding people for effort and work, of course, result. Schools have a lot more about, much more of an egalitarian ethos of everyone in a group project gets the same grade, whereas in work, there's going to be a team leader who makes more money and gets better evaluations if the team is running smoothly, and otherwise you go and punish the leader for that, but he can in turn punish recalcitrant employees for not getting with the program. So yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of similarities, and just compared to nothing, school is doing a good job, but I don't think comparing school to nothing is a very strong defense.
We were casting around looking for arguments against your case against education. One of them has come from Michael McPherson, who's the president emeritus of the Spencer Foundation. It's a group focused on education improvement, and he wrote this critique of your book in the journal Education Next. And one of the things that he says is that education, and he cites a couple of examples of this, education really does make workers, in fact, more productive. And in that sense, it contributes to the economy. And one of the things he cites is this study by this Nobel laureate, Theodore Schultz, this study of family farms, who found that people who got an education had more productive farms than those that didn't have an education. Another one is that he looks at these studies of the major growth of Asian economies between the 70s and the 90s and says, look, their investment in education in these countries absolutely had an effect on their economies in a positive way. Now, so what's your response to that, basically?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the easy response is I looked at a giant pile of evidence and didn't just pick out these two things, which he's talking about. But yeah, so the Schultz study, I mean, that one has a huge problem, which is doesn't consider the possibility that it's richer and more upwardly mobile families that send their kids to school, regardless of the farm. So, like makes perfect sense that if you're a successful farmer, you're gonna be more interested in sending your kid to school, right? So, I mean, like we see this in every society that richer and more successful people are more likely to send their kids to school. And of course, also the possibility that richer and more successful families have kids with more talent to begin with. So there's that. In terms of the East Asian miracle, there is a much broader literature that just looks at the general question of, does increasing the education of a nation have a big effect upon national productivity? And the people who do this research desperately want to find the answers yes, but the standard answer that they come out with is not that much. So, going and looking at countries that raised their education a lot and also had a big gain in productivity, I would say this is exactly what's called cherry picking, where you go and try to find the cases where your theory works and ignore the fact that on average the theory doesn't work very well. So the main thing that I can say is that if you look at all the papers that go and see if you go and raise the average education in your workforce by a year, how much does that raise national income? And then compare it to the papers that look at if you raise an individual's income, or rather raise an individual's education by a year, how much does it raise the individual income? So a finding of every paper I've seen is that national education is less rewarding for nations than individual education is for individuals. This is true even in countries like India, where notoriously the schools work poorly, teachers don't show up very often. Even a place like India, if you get more years of school, which is probably years of school where the teachers are absent a lot of the days, you still get a big raise in the labor market, and yet you don't see very much effect on the overall economy. Which again, fits very much with my story, because I'm saying that if an individual gets more education than other people, they stand out from the pack. But if you're not learning very useful skills in school, then if the whole nation does it, the whole nation can't stand out from the pack. If people were learning useful skills, it would be a totally different matter. Then that would be a way of enriching the country. But if you're just learning something that goes in one year out the next, or if it's just not very applicable, then it's pretty unlikely. Now, like in the paper, I relied very heavily on this one paper that actually went and said, let's go and look at all 8 known data sets. Because this is also an area where when you compare nations, you'll have data from like Kazakhstan or Mali, and then who knows what's happening with the data, right? So anyway, so this was a paper where they looked at all 8 data sets that anyone's used, and for all 8 of them, they were finding unusually small effects of national education on national income. So I'm trying to do the opposite of just finding the papers that support me. I'm trying to just cast the biggest net I can and just say, what does anybody say about this?
I want to come back to this, the section in the book where you talk about whether or not education has an effect on political attitudes, for example, or social attitudes. I thought this was really interesting. You say that the time in school actually does little to promote. For example, you hear this on the right from time to time, that you take kids to a university and it's going to transform their ideology into something leftist, or it's going to undermine traditional lifestyles. You're pretty skeptical about that, too. You're saying that a university is not that influential. It's not going to turn you into a liberal commie, I guess.
Yeah. And by the way, this is the kind of thing that I like people to read if they think that I'm just letting my ideology govern my conclusions. Most of my friends are paranoid about student protesters. Hmm. Right. Why? Most of them have never actually encountered one, but they read about them on Facebook. And so and they're having nightmares about them. But anyway, I'm the kind of person who says, don't go and show me the worst thing in the world that happened yesterday. Let's look at the data. Right. And so, there's been a lot of work that's been done on this by people where the idea is you want to go and get a sample, get a nationally representative sample of people by their education, their political views, and just see how tight is the connection between people's political views and their amount of education they have. And what I say there is, if you look at data for the last 40 years, that there's only a microscopic tendency for people with more education to be more liberal in the United States or to be more left wing. Right. And actually, for Democrat versus Republican, when you count the last 40 years, look like education made people just slightly more Republican. This has probably changed over time, because remember, we're averaging over how the world worked 40 years ago and how it works today.
Yeah.
But again, during this entire time, the professoriate has been pretty left wing, but their effect on their students seems to be pretty hard to find. And to me, the question is just why? Why isn't there much of an effect? There is the story. Well, the reason is that professors, whatever their political views, try to give their students a fair and balanced account of everything that's going on. I will say, I was in school for enough years where I just don't find that plausible. I think I've seen a lot of political bias in the classroom. But another theory, which I think is right, is teachers just aren't very persuasive. Right. So most professors are boring. Since students have low levels of attendance anyway, not surprising they're not being persuaded by the professors that they don't even listen. They don't even attend their classes. But even when they're there, they're half asleep or checking their phones. And then again, like, you know, even teachers who think of themselves as having a political mission to enlighten their students, most of them are unwilling to study communication, like just basic principles of how to talk to other human beings with enough diligence to become persuasive. You know, most professors specialize in talking to other professors, which, again, like, is it's a very alienating way of talking. You know, like, lots of jargon and you know, like not, you know, not explaining normal, you know, not using normal English words. You know, like, for example, like, if I were a Marxist professor and I wanted to turn students against capitalism, I would just use normal language. And I say, look, work sucks. People hate their jobs. Capitalism is to blame. But again, like, an actual Marxist is likely to talk about alienation and, you know, the decolonization of the life space and just use a lot of jargon that just makes people want to fall asleep. So I think that's a lot of what's going on. And then again, you know, so you mentioned in terms of, like, undermining the traditional family. What's very striking now is that the practice of the traditional family is now heavily concentrated among college grads. It's college grads who now get married and stay married and raise their kids in two-parent homes. So, you know, if college professors are trying to undermine the traditional family, they're doing a pretty poor job of it. You know, like, college graduates are the main ones who seem to actually practice the traditional family. You know, so some people like Charles Murray are like, say, well, yeah, that's true, but I'm mad that they don't preach it. Right. So, you may say that, you know, like, there's some kind of strange hypocrisy where college graduates practice the bourgeois values and virtues, but they don't actually go and preach them to the rest of society. But, you know, in terms of actually having their behavior changed, like, if anything, it seems like going to college is pushing people in the direction of you know, like towards the traditional family, not away from it.
It's Brian Kaplan. His book is called The Case Against Education. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Professor Brian Kaplan. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. So here's the question you ask: can education at this point be redeemed? Can it live up to the hype, to our expectations? And you're not terribly hopeful on that. In fact, you say don't count on it. In fact, you say we're so stuck that we're probably immobilized at this point. Mm-hmm.
So that big reform that I am enthusiastic in favor of, just cutting education spending, that's one that I think would work very well if tried, but I don't see it being tried. Just goes so against almost all normal human political emotions. It's important to remember that support for education is not limited to liberals in the United States. It's not limited to moderates. You'll see it in even very conservative Republicans will generally strongly favor more spending for education. It's a bipartisan view.
Yeah.
Writing it. And so, again, like, you know, if
you you compare education to John Gotti. You say everyone is terrified of testifying against it.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I also point out that, you shouldn't be afraid, shouldn't be so afraid, because there's a lot of people who actually have these thoughts. I mean, there's a lot of people who, off the record, including professors, who will say, yeah, I totally agree with you. They don't want to stick their neck out and defend me. But, I'd say, there's the big difference between people who look at what they actually encounter and accept that as a reasonable way of figuring out what the world is like, and people who just use their daydreams as a way of understanding what the world is like. The first kind of person, these attitudes, again, these cut across ideology. There are plenty of people who have, who ideologically would just not like my book. But if they keep their eyes open, and if I just say, well, look, you teach, what do your students look like? How do they act? How much effort do you see them putting in? How much do you think they're really taking away? I mean, when you make it that specific, I find there's a lot of people saying, yeah, well, like, on that way, you're right. In terms of everything I know and see, you're saying the truth. But there's just couldn't it be better? And that's like, could be.
But you're, so what you're saying is you don't have a remedy for this. I mean, what you do, mm-hmm. I mean, what you say is stop, cut education budgets, transfer the financial burden of education away from taxpayers to students and their families. Basically, what you want to do is separate school and state.
So, you know, that is a extreme view that I am willing to endorse. I mean, I also say, you know, it's not at all integral to the argument of the book. You know, again, like if people would read this book and say, let's just go and cut education spending by 20%, I would consider that a fantastic victory. I mean, I think getting people to do even a moderate reform like that, you know, it's very hard. I mean, what's striking to me is how often I'll say, how about we just cut spending by 5%? And then people say, ah, so in that case, you know, like no poor kid would ever be able to go to school again. And I'm like, I said 5%, not 50% or 95%. I mean, we're talking about cutting spending back to the level where it might have been 10 or 20 years ago. So, like, you poor people still went to school back then. So what are you talking about?
You know, what's interesting is you're an economist, and what you're arguing is that if you take the, for example, if you take the stigma out of not having a higher education, not having a degree, that you will have better job prospects for employers. And it sounds like what you're trying to do is kind of change the way potential employers think about who they consider. And I'm surprised that the market wouldn't work this all out. Is it such a strong cultural draw? Is it such a taboo that a job prospect doesn't have a degree that you won't even think about them, that the market wouldn't favor that? I mean, it's such a strong draw that the market won't play out.
Yes, that's a great question. So here's the main thing I'm saying. The stigma that employers have against less educated workers is based on fact. If you change the nature of the people with less education, you change the stigma. So like I said, like in 1950, there wasn't a very strong stigma against high school dropouts because back in those days, there shouldn't have been much of a stigma against high school dropouts. There were plenty of really good workers back then that had dropped out of high school. Fast forward to the modern world, now there's a big stigma. But again, it makes sense that there's a big stigma because since it's only a small number of people who don't finish, it really says something negative about you. So again, I'm not trying to change the stigma by preaching at employers. I'm trying to change the stigma by changing who has a lot of education and who doesn't have as much. Right now, this is the kind of thing where you're changing the nature of students. So I think that the kind of pressure that you can get from schools and from parents especially. So right now, it's very normal in school not just to place everyone on a college track regardless of their academic performance, but also just to have a lot of propaganda about how like every student at the school should be going to college, right? And that's the kind of thing where if you're talking to a naive young person, like, you know, I think a lot of them will actually go along with it because like what else are they going to do? They don't know anything about the world. All they know is what teachers and parents and peers tell them. It's not like they got very little firsthand experience. Hardly anyone in high school has a job anymore. And just to go and change the message that schools are giving people, just to say, if the message instead were there are many ways of succeeding, let's go and let's expose you to each of them. And of course, there's one thing where you just do lip service. You say that once and then it's back to college for all again. But, if you really were built into the daily warp and woof of school, if you were to go and say, let's go and expose kids to 20 different non-college jobs that pay well and see whether they're good at and like any of those. Right. Or, if we could go back to the time when guidance counselors would just be honest with people and just say, based on your grades, it seems really unlikely that you're going to be able to finish college. And if you don't finish, then there's not much payoff. So let's think about some other options here at least. So this is something where people get really freaked out at the idea of like tracking a 13 or 14 year old for a career. And this is where I say, that it's totally reasonable to get freaked out about telling a 13 year old you are a plumber now. But again, how about going and taking 13 year olds and saying, like, let's go and work 2 weeks each in 20 different jobs and see if any of those look good to you.
Seems like there's a case to be made that you're making one for those people who just aren't cut out for academic success, but could be brilliant in any number of these jobs now require a college degree.
So there's that too. In terms of students, I would start with high paid jobs that still don't require college, like plumber. Right. Because that's one where one school could go and shift things in a better direction. But also shifting back to a world where a lot of jobs don't require college. Like, why does a nurse need college? Like, why couldn't that be learned on the job? Why couldn't secretary be learned on the job? I mean, even, you know, even things like computer programming in the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of self-taught programmers. Now people in the industry tell me that's really become much less common because people from the social class that become computer programmers, they go to college like everybody else, which means that employers are nervous at giving someone who doesn't have those credentials a shot. Whereas, again, back in 1975, if you say, we only hire college-educated computer programmers, you might be throwing out a third of your applicants. So, or like a third of your qualified applicants. So you wouldn't want to do it back then, but now it's safe.
I should just note here in Utah, for example, our governor, Gary Herbert, is hoping to funnel more state money into vocational education and technical training. In fact, he's calling this year, 2018, the year of technical college education. Is that a good thing? I mean, you seem pretty circumspect about what's actually going to happen, but do you think that does make some sense to transfer the focus a little bit into more technical education?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that's a big improvement for taxpayers. You know, far better to subsidize people to learn actual skills than to subsidize jumping through hoops. Subsidized jumping through hoops, it basically just increases the number of hoops you need to jump through. Whereas you give people real skills, then from the point of view of taxpayers, at least they're getting some extra stuff out of it. And again, when you learn real job skills in school, this means that you can earn more money by making the pie bigger. But if you're just going and showing off, this means that you earn more money by getting a larger slice of the pie of other people. Yeah, so my main skepticism here is just that so often these are cosmetic gestures and they have a big speech saying we're going to focus on it, but they actually don't. I mean, Utah is already an outlier. Last time I checked, you spent less money per student than any other state in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I think even less than Mississippi last time I checked anyway.
That may be right. We go back and forth between Mississippi.
Right, but, and yet your performance in terms of national test scores looks at least average, or I think even better than average, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
So, I mean, given that you're already doing so much better than the rest of the country, I guess I would say I'm optimistic for Utah, just because you're already so ahead of the curve on getting at least similar amount of learning out of a much smaller number of tax dollars.
You have kids.
Oh yeah.
There is no way you're going to say to your kids, guys, don't go to college. It's not really worth it.
So the only way I'd say that is if one of my kids turned out to be a C student in high school, that's when I would start looking around for other alternatives. I try not to say, well, because it's my kid, the math can't apply to my kid. So if one of my kids were like doing very poorly in school, that's when I would start saying, let's try to find something else that you like and that you're good at. But otherwise, definitely encourage them to go to college. My older two sons are twins. They both want to be professors.
Wow.
Right?
And what is the matter with them?
Well, let me put it this way. They've seen my job and they've seen all the other jobs that are around and they say, hey, I want to do dad jobs. Dad jobs looks like a lot more fun than all the other jobs we've seen. Right? And I always try to be very bluntly honest with my kids. They say, look, what you see about being a professor, it's a great job if you can get it. There's about 8 very unpleasant hurdles that you have to pass by. And I can go and give some guidance on how to pass those hurdles, but a lot of them do. People stumble over them, and you have to realize that could happen to you. But at the same time, I will say, look, you do fit the profile of people that could be good at this, right? And just try to honestly assess it. So I mean, like my older kids, I'm actually homeschooling them, which given my views on signaling, make me very nervous. But that's why I didn't just I looked very hard before we left. So I went and tried to contact the leading researchers of homeschooling. I found a guy at Stanford who does it and just said, look, just be honest with me. How much discrimination is there against homeschoolers in college admissions? Because if you want to be a professor, especially, you need to go to a top school. And the answer that I got is, well, back in the 80s, there probably would have been a lot. But now there's so many homeschoolers that now it's not that weird anymore. But even then, there's a bunch of things that I teach my kids where I say, look, you're never going to use this again, but we got to do it anyway. So you're probably never going to need a foreign language, but you need a foreign language to go to college. So I say, look, we're not just going to go and put in a little effort. We're going to learn it so we can get 5s on the advanced placement test so no one can deny that we know our stuff.
Yeah, what you're saying is to them, hey, guys, I'm not crazy about the game we have to play, but we have to play it.
Yeah. I also do try to spare them unpleasantness that I think that they can weasel out of. So we, when we, my older sons, they have a passion for learning. They love this stuff. They're a lot like me in that way. And so, and I think about how hard my life was, as a kid and how unhappy I was, and I try to spare them that. But I also try to say, all right, these are the things where we can do something different and we won't get punished. These are some other things where if we do something different, we are going to get punished. So let's go and improve our lives in the areas where people aren't going to stop us and ding us for that. But then we're going to go and take some of that spare energy and we're going to really excel in the areas where it counts.
Well, I want to ask you this finally, because you say something in the book that I found interesting, just in the context of how laid bare you make this issue. You say that one of the things you want to do is revive people's sense of wonder.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
Yeah, so you're in school for so many years that you just take it for granted that this is the way that the world has to work. And yet, if you just step back and imagine explaining our system to a Martian, it's a very odd system. Mm-hmm. One where you say, okay, well, here's what we do. We go and study the following subjects. We study, reading and writing, and also history, foreign language, art, music. We do poetry. We do Shakespeare, like English was spoken hundreds of years ago. We do higher mathematics that's used in barely any jobs. And then after you do all this stuff, if you do really well at it, then you get to go on to yet another school where you go and specialize in a subject you're unlikely to use. And yet at the end of the day, when it's finally time to get a job, it's really important to have performed well on all these studies that seem barely related to what you're going to be doing in life. Right? And just realizing how... just the way that students are so eager to find the easy A's. Basically, I want to go and find teachers that will not require me to learn anything and then will give me a good grade as a result. And that's what I want. And I'll pay good money for that. Right? This is normal student reasoning. Mm-hmm. Right? Or just the way that people will cram for the final exam. And then right after the final exam's over, they just happily forget everything they learned. Right? This is totally normal student behavior. This would be very strange if school were a skill factory where you were getting prepared for what you're going to do later in life. But it makes a lot of sense on my story that the main thing you're trying to do is jump through a bunch of hoops and impress employers.
It's Brian Kaplan. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University, author of the book The Case Against Education. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Tim Slover. Our thanks to Claire Jones. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.